This is The Guardian.
I'm Noor Haider, coming to you from Gadigal land, and this is the full story. Online platforms like Discord, Telegram, and TikTok are awash with violence in an attempt to disrupt radicalization.
It did just make me wonder how this regime, this kind of broad anti-terrorism legal regime we have in Australia, is.
Children charged under such laws have an autism diagnosis, language challenges, or social issues.
And especially with really young people,
you know, seeing extremist material. It's Monday, the 20th of April. Ariel, welcome back to Full Story.
Good to be here.
You've been looking into children charged with terrorism-related offences over recent years. One of the cases you looked into involved a 14-year-old who we will call Sarah. Why did that case stand out to you?
So for a few years now, I had noticed a kind of steady drumbeat, I suppose, of young people, children as young as 13, 14, being charged in Australia with an offence of possession of violent extremist material, both federally and in South Australia, which has its own specific laws on the books. And this case of Sarah, which is a pseudonym, struck me when it started being reported in the media and I chased down the court documents in order to more fully understand what exactly had happened here. So Sarah, she was 14, a family member found disturbing videos on her phone and reported them to police. Counter-terror detectives came and seized her devices, her school laptop. And when she was interviewed by police, Sarah told them a lot about what her interests had been. She had developed an interest in nasheeds. These are chants often based on Islamic beliefs. She started to search for information about wars and her faith. She told police she had no intention of hurting anyone. And she was charged and arrested with possession of extremist material. And it became clear through the sentencing remarks from the court that she had no intention of hurting anybody. Perhaps she did not fully appreciate the wrongfulness of her actions, is something that the magistrate said at sentencing. She may not have fully understood the intentions of the people that had sent her material or the harm of her engaging with them. And she did plead guilty. The case was in fact diverted out of court to a mediation process called family conference. But this was just one of a number of cases. And another thing that really struck me was that a clinical psychologist in the court described her as a young, naive Muslim girl with autism. When I started pulling together as many court records of these sorts of cases as I could, I did find that many of the children charged under these types of offences had a range of personal issues that might include an autism diagnosis, language challenges, social issues, and things like that.
Can you tell me more about that? Because as you say, your investigation found that some of the children charged under these laws have learning difficulties or other forms of disabilities. What did you find? And can you talk to me about some of those other cases?
So I was looking at cases around Australia, you know, these cases in South Australia specifically, but also in Canberra, in New South Wales. Around the country, young people have been charged with these types of offences. And there was, you know, in many of these cases, some indication that the child had, in some cases, a difficult upbringing or learning disabilities, language challenges, sometimes an autism diagnosis. And there were specific challenges associated with that, which often were pointed out to the court by clinical psychologists. And it did just make me wonder how this regime, this kind of broad anti-terrorism legal regime we have in Australia, is interacting with vulnerable young people, and especially with really young people, you know, 14, even 13, are they aware that they are committing a crime when they download a clip, a video of something horrible by all means, or something really heinous? They may understand that it's wrong or transgressive, but do they know it's a crime? And this was the question I kind of went into this piece with.
And we'll talk about that in a moment. Tell me about the laws. They were brought in late 2023, or at least the federal aspect of these laws were brought in that year. Why were they introduced and what do they criminalise?
The crime of intentionally possessing violent extremist material only became a federal offence in 2023. It was kind of part of a suite of new laws which aimed to address the kind of spread of violent extremist material in the community. And to be clear, possessing material that might support the preparation of a terrorist act, you know, like instructions about how to create certain types of explosives or instructional material around terrorism, that has been illegal for a long time. This is a new additional offence. And something quite similar has actually been on the books in South Australia, as I mentioned, since around 2017. There it is also a crime to possess extremist material. So when this law was introduced in 2023, there were concerns raised, especially around how they might affect young people. So this issue was flagged from the beginning, that people might not know that they were committing a crime when they engaged, you know, intentionally downloaded this material, because unfortunately it is so pervasive on the internet. So the types of material people have been charged with are videos related to ISIS, the Christchurch terrorist attack video. But unfortunately, this type of material is available in many dark corners of the internet, but also on mainstream parts of the internet. So it's an interesting question of when it becomes illegal, when is it extremist material and not just horrific kind of violent material. These are very sticky legal questions.
Mm. So authorities don't need to prove that the individual had any terrorist intent, but rather that they were in possession of this material. Do we know how many young people have fallen foul of these laws over recent years? How many have been charged with breaching that law?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I tried to pull together as many court records as I could to understand the picture here, not only of how many children have been charged, but also what kind of children they were, what kind of lives they had led, what kind of crimes they had allegedly committed. It is difficult to get that total number, but according to the Independent National Security Legislation Monitor, who kind of oversees laws relating to national security, 60% of people who have been charged with the offence of intentionally possessing violent extremist material at the federal level were children. That's quite a remarkable number. And I also got data from South Australia Police, and they told me that at least 10 people under 18 have been charged with the offence there since 2017. That's compared with about 26 people who were 18 and over. So that's charges there. So they may not have necessarily been convicted, but it does show like a pretty significant number.
Ariel, you mentioned just a moment ago that the internet can be a deep, dark place. Where are young people coming into contact with it and then potentially saving it on their phone or on their device?
So reading through these court documents, young people were coming into contact with this material on a range of platforms. I saw mentions of Telegram, which is a chat app, Discord, which is a chat app more commonly associated with gaming, but another kind of chat community where files can be shared. Also just your typical kind of WhatsApp and online forums and things like that. And often people were engaging in these communities where this material was kind of traded, where it became a kind of transgressive activity, I suppose, to collect and share it. And, you know, speaking to people who work in this space, I spoke to Andrew Zammit, a terrorism and security researcher at Victoria University, and he pointed me to some reports which kind of put this stuff in perspective, especially to a report that was published in 2025 that found that about of 24 gore-related websites that hosted terrorist material, as well as war footage, extreme pornography in the UK, they received an average of 1 million combined total visits per month from the UK, largely from young men. It's quite a striking finding, but it kind of, I think, shows you how pervasive this material is online and how common, in a totally tragic and disturbing way, I suppose, it is to engage with it.
Now that these laws have been in place for several years, what are some of the concerns that are being raised about how they're operating, how these laws are working in practice?
Yeah, a lot of the people I spoke to who were both lawyers who have worked in these types of cases, security researchers and psychologists as well, who have provided kind of clinical reports to courts and things in these matters, I think there was a broad concern that it was difficult for a lot of young people to tell when something was criminal to possess. So not only that it was violent or offensive content, but what was legally defined as violent extremist material. I think, you know, young people are exposed to a lot of this material online, but also as part of news reporting. When does a piece of content become illegal? When you also see similar types of content, perhaps on the nightly news or on your Instagram feed, when we see coverage of conflicts around the world or of political groups or terrorist activity. And Robin Young, a psychologist and autism researcher at Flinders University, she said it was a little blurry for some young people to understand what kind of content would be legally classed as extremist. And she said that there needed to be far more education for young people about the wrongfulness of a lot of this material, because many people would not appreciate that downloading this material is necessarily against the law. And it's interesting to reflect that the Law Council of Australia told the government this back when they were considering passing the law in one of its submissions. You know, the rule of law, it said, requires that the law must be both readily known and available and certain and clear. One of the critiques that people have raised with me is this: the law is not readily known and available, especially for young people, and not necessarily certain or clear, because when is it news content? When is it violent extremist material? Like, this is a difficult question.
And we'll come back to that question around education in a moment. In preparation for this chat, Ariel, I had a look at the explanatory memorandum that the government put out when it was working on this legislation. And it said that these laws would provide greater opportunities for rehabilitation and disruption of violent extremist networks. Many in the community would want to know that authorities are monitoring and are capable of acting if there is a real threat. Do these laws do that?
It's a great question. I suppose we haven't had all that long with the federal offence to analyse its effectiveness or its efficacy. And the Australian Federal Police Commissioner, Chrissy Barrett, after the Bondi terrorist attack, did comment on the fact that the federal legislation around violent extremist material had, she said, quote, been extremely useful because it had allowed us to get in early under the radicalisation pathway and put people either before court or disrupt their behaviour at a very early stage. And authorities in Australia have been, you know, there has been a steady drumbeat, I suppose, from them of warnings of greater radicalisation of young people. And I think in the view of a lot of law enforcement, this kind of legislation helps give them a reason to intervene earlier. I guess, though, the critique here is from some of the researchers I spoke to is that it's hard to understand when the law has effectively prevented somebody from becoming radicalised or committing a terrorist act, because there's no requirement in charging someone to prove that they had any intention to act. This is merely about intentional possession. I think as well, law enforcement in Australia is facing continued questions about how it deals with vulnerable young people in connection with these types of offences. You know, as my colleague Nino Bucci has reported on, the fact that there was a court finding about an undercover AFP officer who the court found had fed the fixation and doomed rehabilitation efforts for a boy with autism who later faced terrorism charges at the age of 14. And after that case, there was a lot of discussion about whether authorities were dealing with these kinds of matters in the right way and not allegedly pushing children down these paths.
We'll be right back. So, Ariel, what did people tell you about the way that all this could affect the way that a family responds if they identify that perhaps a child or one of their children is engaging with this kind of material online?
Yeah, it's so difficult, isn't it? One thing that was raised with me that there could be an unintended consequence of this kind of legislation, that it could undermine counterterrorism as a whole, I was told, if parents were less willing to reach out to authorities for help if they thought it could put into gear this fear that their child could be imprisoned for this offence, which is possible, I suppose. There does need to be a framework around parents if they have these kinds of concerns. We do need to know if children are engaging with this material and perhaps, you know, being radicalised, it is a risk. But at the same time, there are these open questions about whether this is the most appropriate sort of avenue to deal with it for really young people, and especially young people with certain vulnerabilities. And I should say too, we are in this place where children as young as 10 can be charged with this federal offence, but the Attorney General must also consent to their prosecution of anyone under 18. There's also this principle in law in Australia that for those under 14, the state must overcome this presumption that someone younger than 14 may not have knowledge to form criminal intent. But this is still a 14, 15-year-old.
We know that being in the criminal justice system, having charges, can have lifelong consequences for young people. What kinds of sentences have some of these people faced?
Unfortunately, it's difficult to be entirely definitive about like the trends in sentencing. I did see a lot of cases where people were diverted into counselling, into family conference. So a lot of young people were not getting custodial sentences necessarily off the back of these charges. But I think we shouldn't underestimate how intense it is to be before the court. You know, some of the kids had been taken into custody. You know, in some cases, this was not their only offence that they had been charged with. So there were quite serious matters on the table. But it was a range there. And I think we should be thinking about whether the court system is the best way to intervene when a young person is engaging with this type of material. Is this the most effective kind of holistic mental health informed way of approaching this problem? Because, you know, reading through some of these cases, I still think about one matter relating to a 15-year-old in South Australia. You know, reading through the sentencing remarks, you get the story of somebody's life. Often it can be just so tragic to read about. And in this case, the magistrate acknowledged this 15-year-old's severe language disorder, social issues, and disrupted childhood, and gave this quote, "You were given access to the internet unrestricted at about the age of 5, and it would appear that the internet has largely raised you." You know, that's kind of stuck with me. For some of these young people, this is the kind of lives that they're living.
So what would be then the appropriate response or solution? Do people want the legislation changed or amended, or is it the case that education is needed?
Education was certainly a theme that I got from a lot of different experts in this story. My colleague who I wrote this story with, Nino Bucci, our law and justice reporter, he spoke with Dr. Vicky Gibbs, who's a clinical psychologist and the head of research at ASPECT, which is the Autism Spectrum Australia. And, you know, she talked about making sure that there were a range of options available for parents who are concerned about a young person's online behaviour. In some cases, counter-terror police have referred some children on for individual kind of needs-based assessments. Other clinical psychologists also reinforce this education point. Are children being taught in schools about the kind of material that it is illegal to intentionally possess? These are, I think, questions that adults would struggle with. I'm not quite sure how an education program for young people would necessarily work, but there was a lot of concern. And Dr. Andrew Zammit, who I mentioned before, terrorism and security researcher at Victoria University, in his view, he told me on balance that this was a bad law that raised more practical and moral problems than it solved, especially because it was hard to judge whether this kind of law would actually help prevent terrorist attacks, because there was no need to prove this nexus between possessing the material and any sort of terrorist intent. So these are the sort of sticky questions this law continues to raise for a lot of people.
Ariel, as always, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
That was Investigations reporter Ariel Bogle. You can find more of her work on theguardian.com, and we've linked to her latest piece on the Full Story page. That's it for today. This episode was produced. I'm Noor Haider. Thanks for listening.